significant because traffic crashes are the number one cause of death for children. Parents often put their kids in seat belts that don't fit properly and safely. A booster seat lifts an older child up to a height which corrects the problem. To help combat this alarming trend, the National Automobile Dealers Association has joined in a national campaign to raise public awareness of the importance of booster seat use. For more information on the proper use of booster seats, visit www.nhtsa.gov and click on Child Passenger Safety.
And you're listening to put that down, it's expensive. You're listening to WUSB in Stony Brook. Seriously. It's another exciting edition of Off the Wall. This is a little much to take in. The theme is a little bit. Spontaneous parties breaking out everywhere we go. We were late because of what was going on in 25A. People just bursting out into dancing and celebrating that John Bolton is gone. The station, we can barely walk into the place. It's mayhem, but it's good mayhem. Kyle, come down off the table.
I'm sorry, I was just hanging up another piñata. The mustache on these is so realistic. It's great.
I don't even know half these people. It's really cool. I was thinking this kind of celebration would happen when Trump was kicked out of office, but I'll take this. This is fine. I don't even know where the music is coming from. Let's close the door a little bit so that... Okay, that's better. We can't close it all the way. There's so many people in here. John Bolton is out. The security advisor, Trump kicked him out. And unfortunately, I made kind of a stupid promise today on Twitter. I said that Trump gets a free pass for the rest of the day. I'm not going to say anything critical about him because he fired Bolton. And I forgot I was on the air today. So that's going to make things kind of difficult for me. Not for you, Kyle. You didn't make such a promise. So I can't comment on anything.
Yeah, well, okay, we'll see how long it lasts. I mean, it's a gift that keeps
just close the door.
Gifting. And okay. Anyway, yeah, I'm ready with whatever you have, and I'll restrain.
What's wrong with our theme? Our theme is skipping.
You think you can invest in a
new
CD?
It's all the vibration of the dancing. People, can you just open... Guys, can you just not jump up and down, huh?
It's that part of the song, I think, that people start jumping,
all right,
clapping.
Well. All right, see, that's better. When they stop jumping up and down, the CD can play.
Yeah.
Oh, and can we handle that many people on the second floor? I don't know if we can do that.
It's a new building, and Stony Brook's been doing really fantastic engineering work lately on their structures.
Yeah, but have they tested it on several hundred bouncing people? I don't know.
I don't know either.
We'll find that. It's a learning institution.
Have to put our faith in it, I think.
All right. Well, we will. So how will John Bolton's dismissal affect U.S. foreign policy, you ask? In Afghanistan, he was a fierce opponent of the plan for the remaining U.S. troops to leave by the end of the year. Yet, ironically, only this weekend, Trump appears to have come closer to Bolton, decisively abandoning his plan for extraordinary talks at Camp David with Taliban leaders. Can you imagine that? He was bringing Taliban leaders to Camp David days before 9/11, the 9/11 anniversary. And I can't say anything about it because I promised I wouldn't. It's just extraordinary. It's wow. I did not see that coming.
It's insulting. It's insulting to a lot of the generation of soldiers that went and died over there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's insulting, I think, to people that have been victimized in one way or another, directly or indirectly, by extremist policies. Mm-hmm. So that's nothing short of insulting. But I think the real thing that people were critical of, or that they just can't stand any more of, is that this leadership doesn't even see that, or doesn't care about it, or both.
Well, okay, I can't really say anything about that, but what I can say, since I'm talking about John Bolton today, and I haven't made any promises to him, in Venezuela, he conspicuously went into meetings with documents emphasizing plans to send U.S. troops into the country, presumably to overthrow the left-wing government of Nicolas Maduro. He wanted to invade Venezuela. He wanted to drop bombs on Iran. He wanted to drop bombs on North Korea, you know? And I have to say, today, with today's action, I think we're a lot safer because he was a lunatic. He was a warmonger. He's somebody who just thought dropping bombs was always the answer to everything. And what was it? And basically, we are a safer place now as a result of that.
Are we, though? I mean, really? We're safer? There's no... I mean,
Safer, not safe. Safer. You know, one less lunatic.
Wait, no. It's like we don't have that particular lunatic with his expertise and lunacy. We have no one. We have temporary leadership there. Is that really safer? Is it? What about? I mean, this is like Donald Trump wants to step in and moonlight as the national security advisor. It's like one of his sons could be installed to do that, right? Eric Trump could be our national security advisor. What?
Yeah, but he can't even find the offices. I'm sorry, but somebody who knows what they're doing, and say what you will about John Bolton, he knows what he's doing.
Right.
He is evil incarnate. He is a warmonger. He is somebody who, I call him a lunatic, but he really knows what he's doing.
No, I agree with all.
And it's scary.
That.
And not having him, have keys to the building anymore. That is a good thing. I don't care, how many other lunatics there are. One less lunatic means we're, one step closer to the right direction. That's what I think.
I'm with you, but I'm not going to say we're safer.
How is that not safer?
With all of that, but I do not think we're safer, per se.
Well, I didn't say we're safe. I said we're a little bit safer.
Sure.
Having one less crazy person.
You can
person
say that. I don't
that wants
agree
to bomb
with it.
Everybody and start World War III. We're better off.
I agree to the point where, maybe John Bolton has a list of targets. Like, I would, in this moment, be more less surprised if it was just indiscriminate bombing. That's not better. Mm-hmm. Than specific, outrageous, and abhorrent bombing. But I don't know. I guess time will tell. Yes, we'll see who replaces John Bolton. Maybe Eric Bolton.
Well, maybe nobody will replace him. Maybe it'll just be, a stopgap thing for a while. But the thing is, we're not imminently going to drop bombs on countries based on his say-so anymore because he is no longer in favor. And, it's... It's definitely a step in the right. Why is it whenever we take a step in the right direction, there's somebody to tell me that it means nothing? I want to feel happy. I want to join those people out there. Unfortunately, I have to be on the radio, but come on, people are happy all over the world, and we should celebrate a little bit because I'm sure there'll be bad news. I'm sure at midnight I'll be criticizing Trump again, and for now it's he did the right thing.
And who's next?
Who's next what?
In the discussion we're having.
Okay, I don't know, Kyle. You tell me. All right, well, maybe you're a John Bolton fan. I don't know. I don't know what. Why this is something you don't feel is a good thing, but it's... okay.
I'm saying, feel good. Feel plenty. Feel
I'm
as
trying
good.
To feel good, for God's sake.
That's clear. It's
you have to try really hard these days.
Yeah. It looks
but, you know,
really
we have
uncomfortable.
To, we have to stop falling into this pattern of always being miserable.
I'm not falling into anything.
No,
I'm disagreeing with you.
Disagreeing about what? What are you disagreeing about?
I don't think we're safer without John Bolton or with him.
Okay,
I think
so
we're
let me
in
ask
the
you this.
Exact same amount of peril.
How about we have five John Boltons? Are we any more less safe? Or how,
that's
it's
not
gotta
possible.
Be a better way to
that's
say
a
that.
Stupid.
No, that's not stupid.
Stupid
that's, look,
thing to
you,
say.
You have even more of his ilk. In command.
That's ridiculous.
Are you not more in a more dangerous scenario? Then?
That's ridiculous.
Why is that ridiculous? It could very well happen.
It's not a possible scenario
yes,
to even
is.
Be a hypothetical.
No, it's not.
There is one
tomorrow.
Of that individual.
Okay, there is one of that individual, but there's a Steve Miller, too. There's a million of them.
He has a different job.
He has a different job, but they're all evil, and they all want to do bad things, and there are many of them, and they could all be let in tomorrow.
So competent,
it could be worse.
Competent
it could be even
versus...
worse.
Incompetent evil is equivalent.
Look, there are a lot of evil people in the world. There are a lot of evil people...
In my view.
In certain administrations, which I will not name today, but...
You just want to argue. I don't
no,
care,
I don't want
really.
To argue.
I honestly don't care.
I'm trying
care.
To make a very simple point, and every time I try to make a very
point.
Simple point, there are people that want to debate that simple point. And
no
I'm
one's
trying to
debating.
Say, I'm trying to say that having John Bolton out of there is a good thing. That's all I'm saying. That's all those people out there are saying. I mean... Boy, leftist, really? Why can't we ever just be happy for a little while? One day is all I ask. Yeah, the same thing. When Obama got elected, you know, there were all these people that, oh, it's not going to make a difference. It's going to be all the same. When healthcare came out, same thing. Oh, it's not what I want. It's no good. It's just like everybody else. It's different. Things are better sometimes. Things are worse sometimes. We have to acknowledge that. It's not everything we want. It's not always the best, but it's something. And him getting his ass kicked out of the White House, I am happy about that. Damn it. All right, I'm sick of it. Close the damn door. Well,
yeah, it's kind of hard to concentrate.
It really is, and it's sweaty and hot, and my God. And they don't. Those people, they. I think they're just looking for, you know, a roof over their heads because it's starting to look cloudy outside. Well, you know what? Tomorrow is going to be miserable again. Okay, and I'll be miserable again. You can count on it. But all right, for now, this is. You know, I was looking forward to reading this story, and I can't do it because of this damn promise I made. Maybe you heard about this, Kyle. I mean, I'm sure you did. But basically, the GOP decided to counter the people that might be challenging a particular candidate next year. They're just going to cancel the primaries and not have them so that there is no challenger. I mean, this is kind of Soviet, don't you think? It's Orwellian. And they're just not going to vote. They're just not going to have, not going to ask the people who they want to be their candidate. They're just going to assign a candidate.
Yeah, they are all about the one candidate, and they don't want to let anybody else in. And that's what they do. Hopefully, they self-immolate.
Well, I don't know. It's really surprising. Every week, it seems like another bit of democracy is chipped away at. It's basically, you know, they change the maps. They have less mean more. Meaning, you know, you get a minority of the vote and you get the majority of the representation. And now, when it looks like things might be embarrassing, they simply say, "No, we're not even going to do it, and we're just going to." Not have the contest at all. It's just wow. I mean, this is not something unprecedented. It's been done before, but never like this, and it never with a particular candidate facing this kind. It's so hard not to say his name.
Well, he doesn't do well with like competition because that would call into question anything, and mm-hmm. they don't have a mandate to call into question anything he says.
No, it just goes to show something about, you know, their confidence, their faith in the system. I mean, you know, the challengers aren't going to win, but they might make things kind of embarrassing or awkward, and they'd rather just not deal with that at all and just shut the whole thing up. And, you know, I just see that reflected in so many different ways. They just want to shut people up that don't agree and just get on with their way and bypass things. And you see the same thing in the Senate. Oh, I can talk about the Senate, you know, Mitch McConnell and all his, you know, ways of shutting down debate or not even having debate.
He's a grim reaper. Did
he,
you know,
is
that?
He is. What a jerk. He is somebody who basically one of the most evil people that should not have this much power, but he does. He does. It's the way the Senate is constructed. You just are able to keep things from ever getting passed, even if you don't represent the majority. And that's a system I think really, really has to be changed.
Like yesterday.
Like 100 years ago. It doesn't work anymore. It's not the same country. The 21st century is not the 18th century. It's different. And we really need to come to terms with that. I don't know why people are so reluctant to modernize, to realize that it's, you know, we're growing up, we're learning. And the founding fathers didn't know about weapons of mass destruction. They didn't know about cities with populations of millions of people. They didn't know all the things that have happened in these couple of hundred years. And we need to continuously be updating things in the same spirit, yes, but not with the same rules and regulations. They don't work anymore. You know, we were watching yesterday British C-SPAN, I guess. I don't know how to describe it. The closing down of Parliament. And wow, that was incredible. That was something else. What do you think?
Yeah, it's called prorogation, I think, is the official term.
I don't even know how to pronounce that word.
They're prorogated or whatever, but it's when the House of Commons and British Parliament is officially shut down. And in this case, I think 5 or 6 weeks before the deadline for crashing out of the EU, which is October 31st. We've covered that a lot on the show. And anyway, John Bercow, the House Speaker, was also committing himself to stepping down at that time, mm-hmm. or if there was a general election called. I believe it was a general election called. He would then step down at that election, because then I guess a new parliament gets voted in. I'm not exactly clear. It was fascinating, yeah, just to try to get everything straight.
There was
and then
so
the
much.
Ceremony mm-hmm. itself was just fascinating and, you know, full of all kinds of tradition as well.
Well, I mean, it's the whole thing. It's just so ceremonial, traditional, all these crazy things going on. I don't, there are all sorts of rules, and I know that Boris Johnson has lost all these votes, including the vote to have the election. And it makes perfect sense why the Labour Party doesn't want to have an election now, because Boris Johnson would probably win that, because Jeremy Corbyn is not the most popular person in the world. And by winning an election, Boris Johnson would get more power. And by getting more power, he'd be able to push through his no-deal Brexit plan, which is pretty obviously his plan. There's no evidence whatsoever that any negotiations are taking place. And having a no-deal Brexit, I don't know what the end game is there. Because it's going to be a catastrophe. It's going to be a disaster. I think there might be some kind of deal with the United States, with certain leaders of the United States, who I'm not criticizing today. But I think maybe there's a false sense of security there, that something is going to secure them if they do crash out of the EU and have bad relations with the rest of Europe. So he lost that vote. He lost the vote to hold firm to the October 31st deadline, and now he's being forced to ask for another 3 months. If the EU even grants those 3 months, he said that he might not even obey the law, which is insane. But what's amazing to me is just watching democracy work over there. You've got people on his party that are standing up against him. Things that our people, our representatives, our senators cannot do in this country. We really, really should learn from their system. Yeah, it's silly. It's crazy. There's all kinds of weird outfits and traditions and things like that. I mean, I saw yesterday at the end of all this, some really stern-looking woman walked into Parliament, and I guess she was a representative of the Queen or something, and she was basically commanding or requesting that they shut down because Boris Johnson said, okay, Parliament, you're suspended for 5 weeks so that you can't debate about Brexit. But she was heckled like nobody's business, and boy, she was giving some dagger looks to the people in the stands or whatever. And this is part of a tradition where she kind of somebody carrying a big stick, and then half of Parliament walked away and did something for about a half hour, then came back and said their goodbyes. Really, really bizarre. I didn't understand 90% of it, but I was still fascinated by it. I was still really enthralled by the rich history of it. But at the same time, this is a system that is not as outdated and antiquated as our system, because they are able to stand up. They are able to make change. They are able to challenge the rulers and not be held hostage by them. Because, you know, Boris Johnson is there. He's sitting in Parliament, and he's got to sit there and take it. He has to be shouted at and questioned directly, and he has to stand up and defend himself. Can you imagine certain leaders in this country doing that?
I think this is good. I think this is a good argument for changing some of the rules of decorum in Congress, because there's so many moments that people are prevented from speaking their minds, and I think the honesty in the House of Commons and some of the quips and sharp wit, I think, really make those impassioned moments. And I think our system kind of disallows people to even get started in taking people to task the way they, especially given with the stakes, you know, how the seriousness, the gravity of many of the things that are taken up in the House or in the Senate. But I really think there are aspects of the rules of decorum that wholly dilute having our representatives truly express how they feel about leadership and their peers.
It's just worth watching. It's so entertaining. The Speaker alone, he just announced his resignation as of the end of October when they close up shop, or however he described it. And, you know, I wonder, can we have him? Because he is just so illustrative in his speaking. He's so sharp and unforgiving as far as challenging people who are disruptive or don't follow the protocol, don't follow the rules. It doesn't matter how high up they are. It doesn't matter who they are. And I respect that so much. It doesn't matter what party you're from. If you're somebody who is able to do that, that is something that we should prize.
I think like the equivalent would be Nancy Pelosi right now, right?
I mean, yeah.
She is the House Speaker for the House of Representatives, at least in the branches of our government. I think that would be the closest. I think there's also a Senate Speaker, right?
There's Chuck Schumer, but he's the minority.
He's the minority.
Yeah, minority leader.
Leader, yeah. It's termed leader in the Senate. But right. Anyway.
It's just not the same. It really isn't. Yeah, it's silly. The Queen is somehow involved, even though she doesn't really get involved.
I think John Bercow should take Nancy Pelosi out for happy hour.
That's his name, John Bercow. Yeah, can we just have him over, you know, hang out in a pub someplace and... Boy, the stories he could tell. Just listen to the guy. That's how he tells people to be quiet, to mind their manners, and, of course, the way he says order, which I can't possibly imitate.
Order!
No, he pronounces the second syllable much more than that. Try it.
No, now I'm embarrassed.
See, not exactly. But every late-night comedian is doing that. Hey, we just got John Bolton's resignation letter. It's...
To the station?
Yeah. No, we have the telex machine.
That's what that person was...
I plugged it in and it came right over.
Wow. I saw the technician. And he had like just a tool kit with him. But...
We keep these old machines around for a reason.
All right.
It's addressed to President Donald J. Trump, the White House, Washington, D.C. No zip code, by the way. Dear Mr. President, I hereby resign, effective immediately, as Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. Thank you for having afforded me this opportunity to serve our country. Sincerely, John R. Bolton. And, you know, it's interesting because it's written on White House stationery and it's addressed to the White House. So, but, I mean, he was staff, I guess, when he wrote it, so he can't have access to that stationery anymore. And that's something else to celebrate. So there you go.
Mm-hmm.
John Bolton is out. So, yeah, it's a red letter day for America.
And it came with a brown paper bag that was on fire as well.
Well, he's going out drinking tonight, I'm sure. And watch out, D.C. Who knows what he's going to do? The guy scares me. It's just, you know, seeing him at the table and all these sensitive talks just really unnerved me.
What's he going to do? Is he going to write a book or is he going to go work for some think tank?
He's going to shout a book and somebody's going to write down what he's shouting. And yeah, I guess we'll see something in about a year. Should be interesting. Come out right about, you know, election time. Who knows what kind of, what kind of, oh, you okay? Girl just fell off the table in there. Is she all right? Boy, they're getting, okay. It's thinning out a little bit, but still, people, just be careful, all right? Sharp objects. Happy times, though. Happy times. Well, actually, it's not happy times for everybody.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
Well, I mean, okay, I don't want to get
give
into that again.
Give me a break.
A little bit happy. Just look, consider it fuel. It gets us to the next fight.
So sarcasm?
Well,
seriously,
okay, yeah,
tone
sarcasm.
It down.
Sarcasm. So that's your fuel.
It's I don't know. It's better than happy pills.
It's diesel versus gas, I guess. I don't know.
Just keep going.
All right, I'm trying. I'm trying. Yeah. All right, so... here's a story. You'll like this because it's kind of a sad story. The number of Americans without health insurance edged up in 2018. The first evidence from the government that coverage gains from Obama's health care plan are eroding under President Donald Trump. And I can't say that's a bad thing, but I will continue to read the story. The data suggests that the economic expansion, now the longest on record at more than 10 years, is still struggling to provide widespread benefits to the U.S. population. Solid gains in household incomes in the past 4 years have returned the median only to where it was 2 decades ago. And despite strong growth last year in the number of Americans working full-time and year-round, the number of people with private health insurance remained flat. So it appears that the attempts to whittle away at Obamacare are succeeding.
And the pharmaceutical companies responsible for the opioid crisis, like all the gains from taking them to task, has that been allocated and will it be reinvested in President Trump's new health care plan that he unveiled?
You're talking about Trump Care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to know, is the settlement and other class action from various Purdue and other Sackler, those billion and trillionaires or whatever. I mean, are they bankrolling his latest update to Trump Care? I'd like to know.
Yes, yes.
I think it's Trump Don't Care, but...
Well, I'm not going to say that, that's for sure. But, yeah, okay, well, it's interesting to see these things developing, and I'm sure maybe in future weeks I'll be able to say more about them. Okay, how about this? Long Island Railroad unveiling some new cars. A nice safe story here. The M9s are coming out. There's 8 cars that will be showing up tomorrow.
Do they have USB chargers?
I'll tell you what they have. They have AC outlets at every seat or every collection of seats.
Okay, I can plug in my hot dog cart. That's cool.
You can dry your hands without pressing any buttons.
Like the Dyson, like the no the
touch,
UV...
No-touch hand dryers.
Okay.
They have toilets, but toilets, more toilets, I guess. Hopefully within the bathrooms. I'm not sure, though.
Ew.
Soap dispensers, faucets in bathrooms. This is so 1970s.
Pretty standard. Yeah. Is there any other part of the train
country,
you could maybe elaborate on?
It's new. Yeah, it's all about the bathroom. Increased window tint to reduce sun glare.
Oh, that's good because we're all going to
be fried.
Yeah, what?
4 32-inch multimedia screens showing ads and service information in each car.
that yeah. doubtless is wrong.
And closed loop seat armrests are less likely to snag and rip clothes than on the M7 trains. That's what we learned, how not to rip our clothes as we're getting off the train. And the seats will be slightly wider because we're fat.
Big old butt. Big old butt.
All right. Well, this is Kawasaki Railcar Incorporated building all of these. First 92 cars were supposed to come out in September of 2017, but their manufacturing was besieged by setbacks, including design problems. And get this, a derailment last year of several of the cars before they could be delivered. How do you derail the cars before you even deliver them? How do you do that? I mean, there aren't many rails to go down before they're delivered. Was it on its way to us and they derailed there? Or was it in the factory and they somehow derailed in the factory? I want to know more about that. But yeah, they're supposed to debut in May. First, 2017, now May. But obviously not, because this is September. It was July, then it was August. Okay, but they're coming. And tomorrow there'll be 8 of them. And they're going to be in the Huntington line. I don't know how they're going to be on all these lines at the same time. Huntington, Hempstead, and Babylon. Those are the three lines that these 8 cars somehow will be on service.
They have Wi-Fi?
Wow. Okay. Always somebody to ask the question that embarrasses people. How about electrical outlets every row of seats, automatic pocket doors in between train cars that open with the press of a button, Kyle?
Oh, that's very
modern.
You
press a button and the door opens.
I've heard they have that in Europe.
And signal displays that tell riders which car they're in, like car 2 of 6. Now, that's a point of contention for me, because, you know, you're ever on the train and you're hitting Forest Hills or something, and they say, only the first 3 cars will platform. You don't know what car you're in. How do you know that? Well, now you can finally, after many, many years, you can finally get that information, because there'll be a little display, which hopefully will give you the right information. And there'll be a digital display on the exterior of the front car of the train that'll tell passengers where the train is going. I thought that was done, like, in the 20s or something, but... Okay, nothing about Wi-Fi, I'm sorry. But let's assume that that's something they're working on.
What about robotic conductors?
No robotic conductors. Unions, you know, you have to, yeah.
What about the robots union?
I can't get into that. Roy Rogers is coming back to Long Island, did you know that? Roy Rogers fast food chain.
I have no idea what that is.
You're going to have to wait a little bit longer, because they're supposed to come back, and for some reason, they derailed as well. There was an agreement last September with Port Washington-based Burger Brothers Restaurant Group to open up to 7 Roy Rogers on Long Island and in Queens, and that deal has fallen through. So I'm sorry to be the one to announce that. It doesn't mean, though, the chain is abandoning hopes of bringing Roy Rogers back to Long Island. We're still looking for good, qualified operators to bring the Roy Rogers brand back to Long Island. Kyle, maybe it's something you might want to pursue.
No, I have better things to do.
Well,
that's my answer to everything right now.
We think it's a great market. It's ripe for development. It's ripe for development. Now, Roy Rogers is best known, of course, for its Western theme, Double R Burger and Fixin's Bar. And they closed their last Long Island location in Shirley back in November of 2010. The chain had a slight shrinkage from 648 stores in 1990 to 40 in the mid-2000s. What did they do wrong? My God. 648 down to 40. But things are looking up. They're going to expand to 48. wow. Okay, well, you know, that's a story of optimism. You know, we're all about the optimism here. So good for you, Roy Rogers. Alive? No, I don't think he is.
Do they serve beef?
I think that's what they serve. Yeah, I think that's what it's all about. Maybe
so
that was their mistake.
Have we thought about the carbon footprint of all these stores opening?
Okay, you know, you can go down to the first store when it opens and give them a lecture about that. I'm sure they'd appreciate
it. Well, I just want to know, are they offering meat alternatives?
Well, right now they're offering an alternative. They're not opening, so there's that.
Okay.
I don't know.
I'm just trying to find the bad news.
I'm trying to find the good news, and it's awfully hard. It really is.
What about farmers markets and the Grange? Can we bring back a public Grange? And what about...
What's a public Grange?
A Grange where you go and, like, sell your vegetables and stuff?
Never heard that word before.
A Grange?
It's like orange with a G instead of an O?
It's like a big place where all the farmers bring their stuff.
I call that a parking lot.
It's like a Grange.
It's time for our film review of the week. are up to 1956? Really? Okay, we've been in third gear on that. Okay, great. We saw a couple of really, really good films from 1956, starting with the Fellini classic, La Strada, which basically tells the story of Gelsomina, a simple-minded young woman, played by Fellini's wife, by the way, which I didn't know at the time, bought from her mother by somebody played by Anthony Quinn, who was an American actor. Didn't know that either. He is a British strong man who takes her with him on the road. And his thing is he goes around to various squares and carnivals and circuses and things like that and breaks out of chains using just his muscles. He ties chains around his chest and says, I'm going to break out of this. And he does. And people applaud and give him money. And
he really just breaks out of a hook.
Yeah.
It's kind of lame.
It's kind of lame, but it pays the bills. And he doesn't have very many bills because he drives around in a truck that's powered by a motorcycle.
No, it's a Harley.
It's a Harley?
It's American. He says that at one point in the film. It's American. It must be a Harley. What other motorcycle was there back then?
Well, I don't know. I don't know anything about motorcycles.
It must be. I mean, it's like, it looks like an American. I don't know. He mentions it, though.
Well, he's American, but not in the film, but he's American
in
real life.
But it's got two wheels in the back. It's like a tricycle, and then it's got like a flatbed. It's a modified one, but it's powered, like you said, by a motorcycle.
There was something about this film that really struck me. It was just the mood, the filming, the overall tone. It's just something that you felt you were seeing something truly momentous. These shots of just this open, barren landscape, whether it's oceanside or just plains, or even crowd scenes where people are just trying to get by or just selling their goods or just walking down the street. It's post-war Italy, and it's black and white. It looks pretty bleak. The story is pretty bleak. It's sad, but there's also bits of happiness contained within it. It was one of my favorites, actually, of all the films we've seen so far.
Yeah, it was interesting how he was able to make something out of very little, like to the point where he's going and buying people and putting them into service for his act,
mm-hmm.
which is itself really not much. You know, it's something out of nothing, as
exactly.
I said. So it's just kind of that industriousness, I think, is kind of cool, like post-war industriousness. And then entertainment, like people wanting to be happy or to maybe escape. I think that theme was very strong with this story.
Well, I mean, the film opens up with basically the girl on the beach, Gelsomina, which is a great name, by the way. She's basically chased after by members of her family saying, hey, this guy is here, and apparently our sister has died because he had bought her sister before.
Rosie.
And something happened. We never find out exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But he's there to buy another one. And for 10,000 lira, he is able to buy the second daughter and take her into his employment. Now, 10,000 lira, at the time, that translated to around $20, but it was still considered a lot of money, and they were able to fix the roof and feed the kids and all kinds of things like that. It's really sad, tragic, horrible in many ways that people are treated that way. But at the same time, you get a sense as to the kind of person she was. Kind of a, you pointed out, she reminded you of Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, that was my first impression, just the mannerisms and the way her way of you know, using body language and reacting and stuff like that. It felt like you're seeing the remnants of the silent film era in front of you, and immediately Charlie Chaplin was coming to mind for me in that moment.
Yeah. Well, it's a story about compassion. It's a story about brutality, and it's a real boy. It sounded like they hurt themselves that time. It's a story about just basically, I don't know.
She also had natural talent too. That's
she did.
Forgot to say that. I mean, he got her for a good deal because she was pretty talented. Ultimately,
she learned how to play the trumpet.
Yeah, and after he's hit her with the switch. Well, whatever. Anyway.
He did do that. There, like I said, there's brutality in this.
She was a fast student.
Yeah,
fast.
Yeah. People say that Fellini was, sexist. I mean, I'm sure he was, like everybody of the period was, but he's also bringing attention to this. And I think when you watch a film by somebody that shows you brutality, it doesn't mean they're being brutal. It means they're showing you something that happens to be real. And I think he gets kind of a bad rap sometimes from people that aren't truly immersing themselves into the story.
I can get that. With a lot of art, and photography for me, I do a lot of stuff that's really sad on the surface, right? And you know, finding quiet and sort of little bits and parts of landscape or whatever it is, that in those still lives or candid shots of people, I like those moments that are kind of beautiful but also like tinged with tragedy, and then that sort of struggle and sort of finding the beauty in that, in those moments of sadness and even in landscapes and different shots like that. I love doing that because it really stirs up emotion in you, and you react, and so even if it's sort of outwardly silly or happy, it can really tug at your senses and contributes to kind of the depth of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the end of the film, you have, I don't want to give away too much, but we are going to do that when we talk about all these films that we see. At the end, you're just left with this feeling of loss, this feeling of something magical has been taken. And it's what the protagonist feels as well. And it's a real, you know, it's not an American film. It's not the kind of message that would be sent in an American film. And it leaves you thinking. It leaves you wanting to see it again. And you know what's interesting about this? Because I learned this after we saw it. We originally watched this with captions, the original Italian. But it turns out, as I mentioned, Anthony Quinn is an American actor, and so is another major actor in the film. And those actors use their real voices for the English dub. And what they did was, for many Italian films, what they did was they simply filmed everything, but they didn't record audio. They dubbed it all in later. They dubbed in the music. They dubbed in the sound effects. But when they actually were doing the film, it was all visual. And there might be some dialogue, but it wasn't anything that they were going to release. Sometimes I'm told that people simply recited numbers so that you'd know, okay, this is scene 49. This is where, you know, you insert this bit of dialogue, which seems to me like you would see them saying that. But when we watch the English dub, you realize he's speaking English when he's talking, and he's got this Brooklyn accent, and it sounds really authentic. And this is one of the few films where they recommend that you watch the dubbed version and not the subtitled version. And it really is a completely different film when you do that.
It just it really left me awestruck. Like, how, just imagine how much extra work that is from a film production standpoint. I just can't fathom. I mean, even the early Moliere, the French silent film producer who was really innovating with all the magic and, I mean, he was doing all these sets and this wild, you know, frame changes with the frames and making himself appear and disappear, which is tedious. That's like stop motion. But this, just omitting audio altogether and then doing it after the fact. I mean, talk about setting yourself up for an immense amount of work. But that was the structure of the workflow they created. And I cannot fathom that. Like, we have it so easy now. And I really like pure filming and pure photography and documentary and stuff that's really natural and using natural light and all of that and so on and so forth. So and on the one hand, may have just been this really monumental task, but maybe it freed them up. You know, maybe it was a good thing. Maybe they spent more time focusing on just the lighting and just the camera movements and so on. And so anyway, but
no, I think that's it. I think it's exactly it. Fellini wanted to focus on the shot, not getting the sound just right. I know when we film things, the sound is always a big problem.
It's the first thing to go.
Yeah.
It'll ruin something terribly. You really need a sound person who's just sitting there listening and mixing and making sure nothing's running out of batteries and stuff. But when you don't have that, it's an entire job you take on top of being like a photographer and director and, you know, whatever you're conceiving. It's easy to mess up. It's if anyone says production is not a difficult thing, I really would beg to differ, because it's very easy to screw up audio and things like that. Even with these integrated systems where it's all, you know, producing a file or whatever kind of format, and that's, you know, it's sort of automatically done for you, as opposed to what Fellini was doing back then.
Now, we mentioned that this was 1956. Actually, La Strada came out in 1954, but it won the Academy Award for Foreign Films in for 1956, which means the 1957 award show is when they recognized that film. That's how it worked back then. Sometimes it took a couple of years. The American film that won for 1956, we just saw this as well. And boy, what an amazing film this was. Around the World in 80 Days with David Niven and all kinds of cameo appearances from all kinds of different famous actors of the time. It was this was a color film, and this was, it was 3 hours long. Didn't feel like 3 hours, but basically, you've all heard the story. This is the guy that just has a bet with a bunch of people at this really snobbish club in London, and says, "I can make it around the world in 80 days." It takes place in the 1800s, late 1800s, and he goes by balloon, he goes by train, he goes by all kinds of different ships, has all sorts of problems along the way, gets into altercations with natives, including Americans, is accused of being a bank robber at one point. It is entertaining. It is such an amazing story and so beautifully shot.
You know, what it doesn't answer for me is, why was he so sure that he would make it in 80 days?
Because this guy was meticulous. We know people like this. Meticulous as far as knowing every schedule. He had about 18 clocks in his room. He kept all this exact time. And of course, at the end, he miscalculates the number of days. That's the twist. Again, we're ruining it for you. But he thinks he's lost his bet, but he actually forgot to take into account the international dateline, which, by the way, did not exist at the time the story supposedly happened. So there's all kinds of things people take issue with. He was meticulous as far as just keeping track of things. He was almost psychotic as far as being exact.
And the process for this video itself was a unique filming process based on the Cinerama format, which is an ultra, ultra widescreen format developed around the same time. And he actually had worked for that company. I can't remember the name of the company, Cineplex or Cinerama itself was a company. But basically, they licensed the technology and had various theaters. In fact, in my hometown, Seattle has a Cinerama theater that had been restored recently and upgraded to a digital system, I believe. And a lot of, I think a couple of them remain. And what they used was three projectors, so they'd capture everything with three cameras. And what made this distinct is it was the same widescreen or similar widescreen format, but it only involved one camera and then to project, it only required one projector. So that innovation lent itself to this. And looking at it just in the print that we had was a DVD print made from a positive, and it was beautiful. It was so beautiful, like just gorgeous color, just full frames. I mean, 20 millimeter like wide lenses. But, you know, just to the point of like distortion and getting curve in there. But it was just, it's gorgeous.
It was produced by a guy named Michael Todd, and the technique he used was called Todd AO, which was a unique way of projecting. It was widescreen. It started off 35 millimeter, then expanded. And you know, in England, I heard this story too. Because England had a requirement for a certain percentage of English films being shown in particular theaters for 35 millimeter films. Well, they shaved off a millimeter, made it a 34 millimeter film, so they could show it and get around that restriction. That is incredible, just hearing that. And of course, if it was 70 millimeters, they'd also get away with it. all sorts of weird stories involving this, but what a story. What a story the film was.
Well, and just that's the technical side, I mean, the production side itself, you could go on and on, but the story and the way they did it was really seamless, really beautiful. Something in addition to the sights and sounds, I mean, the color itself was very just vivid, and you maybe saw in the print like a little bit of like a dirt on a lens here and there, but other than that, it was just so crisp and clear and just seamless tracking shots. And a lot of the wider stuff might have an element of the story, like the balloon or an elephant or something in some jungle somewhere, but you would just see these on location landscapes blended into a studio shot of an interior or a vehicle of some kind, or the boat itself would rock in a really natural way.
You know, the balloon was not part of the original story. Everybody thinks Around the World in 80 Days has to do with a balloon, but the book didn't have a balloon in it. Everyone just, the iconic shot is always the balloon. Also, you know, there are time things in there, references, and I think the worst part of the film is the cowboys and Indian thing in the United States as they're going across the country. But, you know, there are a lot of bad things as far as that goes.
Yeah, like arrows bouncing off people. And
well, the special effects weren't that great.
Shooting indigenous people from the train.
All the Indians died and all the Westerners didn't. But, you know, this is something that of the time, this is the ignorance that people had back then. I'm sure in 100 years, people will look at us in the same way. But that's going to have to do it for us for 1956, 1957. Hopefully next week we'll see about that. We have to go. We're out of time. In deference to the UK and their parliamentary system, we're going to go out with a song about division bells, which is a bell rung in or around Parliament to signal a division and call all members of the chamber so affected to vote in it. And that's probably what they did yesterday. And you can write to us, otw@2600.com. That's our email address. Stay tuned for Finney's coming up next, and we'll be back next week. And I'll be able to talk more freely then, hopefully. Good night.
Beyond the horizon of the place we lived when we were young, in a world of magnets and miracles. Straight constantly and without boundary. The ringing of the division bell had begun. Along the long road and on down the causeway, do they still meet there by the cut? There was a ragged band that followed in our footsteps, running before time took our dreams away, leaving the myriad small creatures trying to tie us to the ground, to a life consumed by slow decay. The grass was greener, the light was brighter, around the nights of wonder. Looking beyond the embers of bridges glowing behind us, to a glimpse of how green it was on the other side. Steps taken forwards, sleepwalking back again, dragged by the force of some inner tide. At a higher altitude, the flag unfurled. We reached the dizzy heights of that dreamed of world. We'll be right back. desire and ambition. There's a hunger still unsatisfied. Our weary eyes still stray to the horizon. Go down this road we've been so many times. The grass was greener.